You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, should have gone to Specsavers, Apple TV, cold callers, the Queen Mum, the Great British Sewing Bee, and the pretend iPod.
Hello once again and welcome to another edition of this, the Parish Council podcast from the Rocking Vicar. Very glad you could make it. I'm Magnus Shaw, and he's about as easy as a nuclear war. It's Terence Dackham.
Young Ha See Yo, Magnus Shaw.
Oh, right. Is this Korean? Yeah. Are we speaking Korean?
Yeah. I'm learning Korean just in case.
Yes, it's not a bad bet, is it, really?
No. So, and Young Ha See Yo. Here's the thing, Magnus Shaw. Here's the thing. From today's news, right, see if you could imagine this happening in our youth. Education authorities in Oslo have rescheduled school exams because they clash with a gig by Justin Bieber. They were worried that school children were going to play truant and miss their exams. And I was thinking, I can imagine my old headmaster's expression if I'd said, won't be in tomorrow. I'm going to Hyde Park to see the Rolling Stones. I can just imagine.
That's all right, Dackham.
Just
give us a shout when you're on your way.
Which, incidentally, Magnus Shaw, I tell you what, and coincidentally, I could do that this summer as well, go and see the Rolling Stones in Hyde Park.
You could if you had a particular brand of credit card with a large maximum spend on it, yeah.
Absolutely. Not for free, like 1969. But yes, I could pay £95 to stand at the back, £330 for VIP standing, not a seat,
no.
VIP standing. Yeah. Or I could have elected to go in the Diamond Circle, £2,500 in the Diamond Circle. Tickets went on sale at 9 o'clock this morning. Tickets sold out by 9:03.
Yes, I don't think these people appreciate that there's a war on, or at least a recession. Where's all this money coming from?
And that's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, it won't be a Hyde Park by the time that rolls around, anyway.
It'll be An Myong Ha See Yo.
Well, yeah, so it would be the radioactive plane outside the walled village, I think.
But do you know what? If people didn't get a chance to purchase one of those 2,500 Diamond Circle tickets this morning between 9 o'clock and 9:03, maybe they can take some solace by buying the vinyl version of the latest Rolling Stones greatest hits, available from the Rolling Stones' own website.
Oh, yes.
The vinyl version, £79.99.
For what reason?
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Please explain.
I know. I couldn't believe it. I was just checking up these ticket prices after I saw that story, mainly but just following on from Justin Bieber. And, the vinyl version of the Stones' greatest hits from their website, yours for £79.99.
They really want to follow in Prince's footsteps, don't they? And when he did an album called 2113 or something equally obscure.
Yes.
When you went to see him, not only did it cost you £21.13 to go in, which didn't seem too bad, he'd give you a copy of the album as you walked in through the door.
It was unbelievable, wasn't it? I was there.
We were both there then. And,
both there.
Yeah.
And that's the way to do it.
Yes, absolutely. And I believe a couple of days later, you could pick up the self-same album with the Sunday Express, I think, or the Mail on Sunday.
So the Mail on Sunday,
Yeah. So when they say the new Prince album, you couldn't give it away. Well, you could.
That was the only way you could indeed.
It did have a track on it called Guitar, which is actually up there with the best of Prince. It was
because I was going to say it wasn't very good.
No, the album wasn't stunning, but there is a track on there called Guitar. If you've still got your little cardboard envelope with your 20,
I do,
yeah. I don't think it out. Play guitar. You'll like that. That's good, that one. Yes, yeah.
I'll tell you what. Here's another thing, Magnus Shaw. I've got to give you an update, because I did mention last week that I'd gone to Specsavers to have my eyes.
Yes, are blind. I cannot see. I've left my specs in the lavatory. Yes.
Right, and they puffed air into my eye. And I remember that. I talked about it. Anyway, I went to collect my spectacles, that I now need to watch television, it's for distance work. So I popped into Specsavers, on Wednesday, and, usual thing, but, you know, walked in. Hello, my name is Dackham, and, apparently my spectacles are ready. Usual thing. Dackham. Oh, okay. That's an unusual name. And, you know, I go through my, I've got a kind of prepared speech when people say, oh, Dackham, that's a strange name. Yes, well, you know, recently, you know, the West Country in the last few centuries, West Country, Dorset, you know, if you think of Ilfra Coombe or Boscombe, you know, the Coombe bit means, valley, so Dackham, man of the valley, or something. And I, and she sort of appeared interested. So I said, well, before that, yeah, that was my mistake. I said, before that, we came over with William the Conqueror, and we're from Normandy in France. And she said, France? Well, you don't have a French accent.
Oh, dear.
Oh, God.
Yeah, she wasn't keeping up, was she?
She wasn't keeping up. I was going to think, oh, that was 1,000 years ago, you know.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that you have a prepared story. I mean, you want to be trying, you want to try being called Magnus.
I did. Like Magnus Magnusson.
Yeah, well, I don't get, you know, it's a generational thing because that has now all but died along with Mr. Magnusson himself. So, as a child at school, every third joke was Magnus Pike, who you'll remember. Oh, yes, Professor Magnus Pike.
The flailing arm scientist. Yeah.
He was great as it goes. He was really, really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And Magnus Magnusson, the two people, you know, in the British media called Magnus, left me wide open for that. But here in the 21st century, I very rarely get references to either of those people. And so it's all moved on. But obviously you do get, I've never met a Magnus before. Where'd you get a name like that from? So I have a bit of a script as well for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I don't mind. You know, I guess if I met somebody called Marmaduke, I might be moved to comment on it. So I don't really mind. But
okay, well.
I only mind when people get it wrong, which is quite often, once a week. I got an email from somebody this week that said, Dear Magus. Now, but that's not even a name.
No,
they've actually mistaken a real name, Magnus, for one that doesn't exist, Magus.
Oh, with me, mine's the pronunciation, you know, I mean, it's Dacum that people say, Dacum, Dacombi.
I mean, I used to call you Terence Dacom.
Oh, yeah, I like that. It's quite sophisticated.
Yeah, I used that for a long time. But what a member of your family listening to the podcast insisted that we put that right. So I'm strictly Dacum now,
So I should hope so, too. My nephew picked you up on that. Yes, indeed. Yes. You know, last week you were referring to wearable technology, and you weren't in favour, and I have to say I think I agree about wearable technology. And as if they heard you and thought, well, we're going to show that Magnus Shaw what he knows. Apple are announcing that they're going to launch their full high-definition television. They're going to call it iTV, which will cause some confusion over here because, of course, you know, iPod and iPhone, and they're going to call it iTV. But anyway, it's going to be a huge television. It's 60-inch screen. There's going to be a slightly smaller model, 55 inch. But here's the thing: this is that I really wanted to get your view on, because wearable technology. The remote control isn't a remote control in the traditional sense. It's going to be what they're calling an eye ring, and you wear this like a wedding ring on your finger.
Yeah,
and it works as a remote control. It acts as a pointer, and you wave it at the TV. Is this going to get you to change your mind about wearable technology?
No, and it isn't. And it's just occurring to me now that we're getting into the technological realms of, just because a company can do something doesn't necessarily mean they should. If you can build a remote control into a ring, realize that, revel in it, take joy from it, then stop and think, but is there any need to do that? And clearly there isn't any need to do that. And you're supposed to wear it all day in anticipation of sitting down in front of your ITV. And if you are wearing it all day, you know, what if it doesn't match your outfit? What if you don't like wearing jewelry? What if people say to you, what's that on your finger? You've got to say, well, it's the remote for my telly. You're going to look a right goon, aren't you? That really makes no sense whatsoever. What is wrong with your remote control just sitting there on the table? Yeah, you know, keep making them smaller so they take up less room on your coffee table, but there's no wearing it on your finger. I don't see why. I don't see the advantage of that over having a box on the table. Don't see it.
No, well, they're taking this sort of, I think, the addiction that people have for devices to quite an extent here, because not only are you going to get this iRing to use the remote, it's going to come with a kind of mini screen as well, a 10-inch display that links to the main, your 60-inch model on the screen. And but the purpose of this is it runs simultaneous with what you've got on the screen, on your 60-inch screen. Because it allows you to view programs as you walk around the house. If you go out to make a cup of tea, you take it with you.
We have two flights of stairs, numbering a dozen each in my house. That would seem like a very bad policy to walk around watching sort of 8-inch television whilst you were navigating the stairs. That's a recipe for disaster. Please. If a program is so good that it's preventing you from going and making a cup of tea, then watch it till the end. You know, there's your reward. You know, you've got what you asked for, a really good TV show. You don't have to take,
you can pause live TV these days anyway.
Yes, of course you can. So it's carrying this, where's my extra screen? I must go for a tinkle. I'm going to take my extras, which then you'll drop down the lavatory. How many of those are going to get dropped down the lavatory? Many of them.
Well, it's $2,500 in the USA coming out this year, so it'll be about a couple of grand when it comes out here. Just one added bonus to this. Last week, I kind of thought you might have been joking when you talked about gloves. Do you remember
that?
And just by sheer coincidence, when I was just looking up this Apple TV thing, high-definition TV, there was a link to other kind of technology aspects. And it took me to a gadget site, and the first thing that came up was Bluetooth gloves.
Yes. It
came up with this Bluetooth gloves. Yeah. Not only are these gloves comfy and warm, but they will wirelessly sync with your smartphone. There's a picture of this girl walking along what I must say is a bit of a shady back street. Yeah. But anyway, and she's got her thumb pressed to her ear and her little finger to her mouth.
That's it.
Is that what you're talking about? £49.99.
I'm interested to say, just completely unnecessary and... apart from that, there's no point in deploying Bluetooth on any mobile device because it means your battery will then last about another 2.5 minutes before it gives out. Why do you need a phone in your glove? If it's syncing with the phone in your pocket, use the phone in your pocket. Anyway, I went to buy a pair of those and they didn't have a scarf to go with it, so I left it.
Fully dry cleanable as well, they tell me on this website. But anyway, there we are. That's Apple TV and Bluetooth.
Yes.
And gloves.
Yeah, we look forward to the interactive pants. interesting when you have to punch the buttons on those.
I tell you what, talking about phones, I don't know if this troubles you at all in your homestead. But now, unless I recognise the number of the person calling, I never answer my home phone anymore. Because despite being ex-directory acting out of marketing calls through this, TPS?
Yeah,
telephone
preference
service. Yeah, I'm still frequently bothered by cold callers. And, you know, there's one number that calls me most frequently. It's 2 or 3 times a day. Give the number. It's 020-8433-4233. And these people won't leave me alone, Magnus. I managed to find out that this is the number of a company called TNS BMRB, which is a bit of a mouthful. But I looked up their website and, I looked up their frequently asked questions page. Because the thing that I wanted to know is, where did you get my contact details from? You know, why are you getting it? So on their FAQ page, where did you get my contact details? I just want to read you what it says. And I don't know, it's making my blood boil. It's just sort of so like la-di-da. They say, well, you know, we may have got it from, you know, a client company, or we may have got it from a government database. Oh, fine, right, mate. And it says... And they just say this so blasé, do TNSBRMP.
Yes.
Random digit dialing, RDD, in brackets. For telephone surveys, we may use a system where telephone numbers are generated at random by a computer program. Well, that's familiar, isn't it? We know that sound when you pick up the phone. Yeah, that's it. This is to ensure that we call a representative sample of people. Now, wait for this. In this way, we may have contacted you by phone, even if you are ex-directory. Please note that genuine market research, they mean themselves, is exempt from the telephone preference service.
Yeah, yeah.
So we may have contacted you by phone, even if you have registered to opt out of sales and marketing telephone calls.
Yeah.
It's an outrage.
Loophole klaxon. Loophole klaxon.
What are you going to do about it, Magnus Shaw?
Well, I mean, what I always do, if I inadvertently pick it, and you know, if it's the landline, I don't have caller display on my landline, so I will just answer it. And if it's immediately, and it usually is immediately apparent that it's a cold call, I stop them before they get too far into their spiel, and I just say, "Did I ask you to call me?" And often they'll say, "Oh, I don't think you understand, sir, that we have a superb offer for you." Or the "Don't worry, it's not a sales call," they'll say, which, you know, translated into proper English is, "This is a sales call."
Yes.
And I always say, no, but just answer this question. Did I ask you to call me? And they say, "Well, no, we didn't." And I say, "Well, I only take solicited calls. Thank you." And hang up. And that's it. I don't think the bellowing swear words thing is A, particularly... you know, intelligent, or, and B, I don't think it's particularly fair, because I know the person making that call doesn't really want to be making that call. He's trying to scrape a living. He probably wants to be a, you know, fine artist, or a potter, or a museum guide, or, you know, something a little bit more intellectually stimulating. But he's found himself, you know, doing this job, and he doesn't need me calling him every name under the sun. But I just quite simply ask, "Did I ask you to call me?" Well, you know, I only accept solicited calls, and that's it.
Yes. Well, the Telegraph this week, they there was a column by a bloke called Max Davison, and he had five tips for how to deal with cold callers and leave them lost for words. And I have to say, I wasn't really convinced. Five tips. I need to sort of summarise them, because it's a whole lengthy article.
Sure.
But number one was, be even friendlier than the cold call.
Yeah.
I like the idea of that. I'm not sure it'd work. You know, counterintuitive ploy, so you wrong-foot them by saying, "Hello, thank you so much for calling."
Yeah, that's like the Jehovah's Witness thing, isn't it, where you actually insist that they come in and take tea and cakes with you. And then after an hour say, "Well, thank you, you know, for telling me all that. I'm not terribly interested in your faith, but I wondered if you'd be interested in joining the Satanists."
His second one is, ask cold callers for their home number, and he says he asks if they can give them a home number so they can continue the discussion on a future occasion, and invariably they refuse. Thirdly, engage them in polite academic discussion. Fourthly, refer them to non-existent legislation. I quite like that one, because if you tell them that you speak in a really authoritative voice.
Under the 1972 Telecommunications Act.
Exactly, yes. Miscellaneous provisions, open brackets, 117 exactly. Section, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Then ask their age is his fifth one. And when they respond with puzzlement, he says, I tell them that, you know, his 91-year-old mother has to get up out of her armchair and hobble across to the phone. So how would they like it? But I don't think any of those would work, to be honest.
No.
They're more cold-hearted.
You could ask them what they're wearing. That might be interesting.
And call the police.
In a husky voice. Say, "What are you wearing?"
I just wish I could stop this TNSBRMP.
Well, there's a really, really good call from America up online. I'm sure it's Googleable. that a guy made. He was being plagued with these incoming cold calls. And so he set up this response. He knew he'd get another call. So when he did, he answered, changed his accent, thick Bronx accent he changed it to, and made out that it was a police officer who'd answered the phone, and said, right. And he said in the police officer's voice that he was in attending a murder scene where the person they were calling was lying dead, and that they were to stay on the line because they were now a material witness.
Oh, fantastic.
And he said, we've been through this guy's phone records, and you've been phoning him every day for the last 2 weeks, so we suspect some close involvement with this crime, and that you've got to stay on the line, and my senior officer will be here shortly to ask you a series of questions. So he spun this out for a good 11, 12 minutes. The guy at the end of the phone was going, I want to hang up, man. I'm just a sales guy. Yeah, you're not hanging up, buddy. You are staying on the line. We got you now, buddy. We got you now.
Wow.
Fell for it hook, line and sinker. See if you can Google that. That's
good. Yeah. The British equivalent, but not in any way in the same league, is a fellow called Richard Herman, because he won a landmark court case last year. He took a marketing company called AAC to court. What he did was, when they kept calling him all the time, so he recorded the calls and then sent them an invoice charging them £10 for every minute he spent on the phone. Did you hear about that?
Yes, or at least something very similar. Yes.
They refused to pay up. He sued them at the small claims procedure of the county court. Brilliant. And he won. And he got £195 and a £25 court fee.
Only other anecdote I can add to this is a guy was being called in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh.
Every day. But, every morning. And, but it was silence. You just get silence every time. And, it was making him quite ill. And he couldn't change his phone number, I think, because he had a building business or something, and that was also the number for the business. And, he had a good reason for not changing his number.
Yeah.
And he had, an elderly parent, so he couldn't put the phone in the other room in case they needed him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfectly plausible reason that he had to keep risking this thing calling, this call coming in. And, he went to the telephone preference service, and they said, right, we've made sure your number's on it. No difference whatsoever. These calls kept coming in, and it was sort of like that the random torture where it would leave him for 3 nights, and he'd think it stopped, and then it would start again. Eventually, he hired a technology company, a telecommunications company, to find out what this was all about and see what was coming. Anyway, the cut a long story short, they traced it back, and there was a drinks machine in Hong Kong or somewhere, which was programmed to call, in inverted commas, a computer when it was short of cola or lilt or whatever,
and
to register its details, which by sending data down a phone line, and the engineer had set it up one digit wrong.
Oh no! Oh my goodness!
So it was supposed to be calling some central number to report I'm out of coke, and it was getting this guy.
Oh,
and of course, because of the time difference, it was calling him at 3 in the morning. And they eventually tracked it down. So he was being driven slowly insane and harassed by a soft drink machine in a different country.
Good Lord. Yeah. Well, that gentleman, and indeed anybody else like me being played by these, that the chap I referred to, Richard Herman, who won that court case, he's actually now set up a website called saynotocoldcalls.com. And I recommend it. It's got some really, really funny, aggravatingly amusing stories on there about, how people get plagued by these things.
I think we've mentioned in the past as well that there's really no need. I mean, it's such a clunky, old-fashioned, clumsy and ineffective means of marketing anything. Absolutely. I'm amazed anybody still does it. I'm amazed.
I know. I totally agree with you. But I blame all of this on downgrading of social interaction, Magnus. It's the over-familiarity of modern life where Starbucks ask you for your name so the barista can misspell it on your coffee cup. And, where waitresses, you walk into a restaurant and waitresses greet you with hi instead of your name. And they say awesome when you give them
your order. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll have the chicken burger and fries, please. Awesome.
And then they don't write down your order because they're so smart, and then they bring you somebody else's dinner. It's a destruction of modern society. And leading from that, this week, the BBC launched its Great British Class Survey, and they said that there are now 7 class groups in the UK. No longer are we just an upper, middle, or lower, or stroke working class. There's now 7 class groups. And I invited you to take this survey. Yeah. And let's tell you the 7 class groups are, from the lower end upwards, precariat, which are the poorest people, emergency service workers, traditional working class, new affluent workers, technical middle class, established middle class, and elite. And you took the survey. You're a man of the left. You've got great socialist values. Yeah. Where did you come in this survey,
well,
Magnus Shaw?
Hilariously, I was established middle class.
Established middle class, yeah. The second wealthiest in the nation,
but you're not.
With a high score culturally and socially. I think, do you have it there in front of you, the description of the established middle class?
Yeah, do you know what? It's I've got it on my screen. It's reset itself in a rather technologically inconvenient way.
That is inconvenient.
I don't have the description. Maybe I can get it back. But you tell us a bit more about the test, what it involved.
Well, it's incredibly unscientific, yes. Because you go onto the BBC website and you head for their survey, as I refer to, the Great British Class Survey, and you basically click on radio buttons, giving your income and whether you go to the opera or you go and see hip hop groups.
Yeah, that's right.
Like
yes,
that.
Do you go to stately homes? Do you go to the opera? Do you listen to jazz? Do you listen to rock? Or indeed, you go to gigs, you go to the theatre. I'm reading these because I'm doing it now to get the result.
Oh, you're working your way through it again.
I'm working my way through it. You can kind of see which way it's leading you. Yes, here we go. So I'm glad to say I'm still established middle class.
Still established middle class.
So this is the most gregarious and the second wealthiest of all the class groups. According to the Great British Class Survey results, lots of people in this group enjoy a diverse range of cultural activities. Well, I can sign up to that. Went to university, which I never did. I've been to universities to watch The Damned, mainly. But I never graduated from one. And apparently I'm comfortably off, secure and established. Well, I got to tell you, I'm a freelance writer, and none of those adjectives really come onto my radar, I can tell you. So I'm not sure of the science involved here.
Well, these 7 classes, working one's way upwards, are the precariat, poorest, most deprived class, who score low economically, socially and culturally. Emergent service workers. These are new, young, urban group who don't have much money but are very social and cultural. They live for today. Traditional working class, score low economically, socially and culturally, but have reasonably high house values and have the oldest average age. New affluent workers, a young group, socially and culturally active with middling levels of income. Technical middle class, small distinct group that aren't so social but have money and are into emerging cultures such as gaming, the internet and rock music. your one, and I understand that The Guardian are cancelling your subscription to their newspaper because established middle class, largest class group, second wealthiest and high culture and socially, and the top, the elite, most privileged group, set apart from other classes because of wealth, highest scoring economically, socially and culturally.
But rather alarmingly, it's only the little icon for established middle class, which seems to be sporting facial hair, I think.
There's a great deal of stereotyping.
Yes, the precariat is just one of the most horrible modern manglings of the language I've come across lately, the precariat.
Yeah, so I've got a friend on Twitter who took this survey kind of with me earlier in the week, and she unfortunately came out at precariat, and I did say to her I wasn't sure that I could keep her as a friend on
but
Twitter.
She was probably, what, an aspiring musician or something? Was she? I don't know.
Yes.
Which would dump you into that low-class group, but really, you know, in terms of attitude and I don't know, social standing, you could be quite high up the scale. But
does it matter in modern society? That was a question I was going to ask you. Does class matter in modern society? As you go about your day-to-day business in your established middle-class world, does it even occur to you when you go into any kind of social interaction what class somebody might fit into these seven groups?
No, it doesn't really. I tell you what, it doesn't matter, or matters least, which is in the creative industries where I've worked all my career. It never really becomes an issue. I mean, I've had bosses who were clearly from. I'm falling into the trap now, but clearly from a sort of lower class background from myself, but I respected them. And, deferred to them because of their skills and their experience. So I don't think it really matters. And I tell you, the reason it doesn't really matter in the creative industries is because it isn't a key factor in penetrating those industries, in being hired within the creative industries. Class doesn't come into it. I think it really does in some other industries, you know?
Yeah. I possibly mentioned this before on the podcast, but just quickly mention it again that what a change from when I was a youth, because you were seen as a classy person. You were seen as probably affluent and highbrow if you went to a job where you had to wear a tie.
Yes.
And that was seen, you know, deemed to be, oh, you know, this sort of officer type, you know, he's got a good job. And, you know, if you were perhaps a sort of working fellow, then you didn't wear a tie. Now I notice that if you go to the Woolsey or One Aldwych or something, all the men in these places, nobody's wearing a tie.
No.
Other than the waiters and the doormats.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
It's gone completely reverse. Mm. So it's a sort of strange twist.
To my late mother-in-law, the absolute epoch of your career, the indication that you were really getting on in your job was if you took the minutes. So my wife, and it was, you know, obviously my wife's mother would say, yeah, she'd say, how you been this week? I've been really busy. It's been non-stop meetings. My wife would say, she'd go, did you take the minutes?
Oh.
Now my wife is, an office manager for in the public sector. And in that role, she really very often did take the minutes, and made my mother-in-law prouder than hearing that her daughter took the minutes at important meetings. But that was because when she worked and my mother-in-law grew up and lived most of her life on Nassau in the Bahamas. But if you took the minutes at a meeting, it was a fair bet that you were a PA for one of the big hoteliers or one of the big airline operators. So, you know, barring the fact that you would never run a chain of hotels or an airline, that was probably, you know, as high as certainly as a woman could get on Nassau was to take the minutes. You know,
Actually, well, I mean, talking about class, I can't let the moment pass because I'm fairly sure I told this story before on the podcast, but it must have been a couple of years ago, so I think I can get away with it. Nobody will know this. it's my Queen Mother story when I was at Windsor Racecourse. It does involve me
Come in the studio, everyone. He's going to do the Queen Mother story again.
It does involve me using the word arse in a quote, but you know, I hope everybody can forgive me.
You just used the word arse outside of the quote, and I have too.
Damn it! Mid 1990s. I was invited to Windsor Racecourse. There was an opening of a new stand, and they had the Queen Mother come along to, you know, cut the ribbon and do all the official bits. And there was a reception after, within Windsor Racecourse in the building set. And I found myself at a table with Major Dick Hearn. He was a racehorse trainer, sadly no longer with us. He was on one side of me, and Her Majesty the Queen Mother on the other side. Amazing situation. Anyway, we've talked for ages about horses, and oddly, I don't think I mentioned this last time I told this tale, but it came back to me. We were talking about horses, but also Elton John we talked about.
Oh, really?
Because, yeah, the Queen Mother had to lean across me and explain who Elton John is to Major Dick Hearn. So it was one of the most surreal moments
Sounds like
of my
Queen Mother was life. Aware of Reg Dwight and his activities.
She went to his house for tea.
Oh, right. Of course she did.
Yeah, reasonably regularly. Yeah.
Okay, well, yes.
Went down to St. Leonard's Drive round to his gaff for tea. Yeah, they were quite friendly, Sir Elton and the Queen Mother.
Yeah.
But she had to lean across me, and she's telling Major Dick Hearn, you know, sort of old-school racehorse trainer, who Elton John actually is.
And with no little irony, of course, Elton is now the Queen Father, isn't he?
Well, yes, indeed.
Do you see what I did there?
I did see what you did there. When time was passing on, and it got time to go, and Major Dick Hearn, he was in a wheelchair by then. He'd had an accident. He was out on his horse, and he came down, and he unfortunately confined to a wheelchair. So he said he would ask someone to go and get his driver. And the Queen Mother turned to us both and said she was so glad that he'd said the word driver, and that she so hated the word chauffeur.
Oh, yes.
And she said it like she was spitting something out of her mouth. Who's chauffeur? I'm so glad you said driver. I hate that word, chauffeur. And she said, so that gave her a chance to sort of tell. She's a great storyteller, the Queen Mother. Mm. You know, well, you sort of see her at sort of events and on TV, and you maybe think of a slightly elderly lady sort of tottering about. Oh my word, she had a sharp brain. Anyway, she said to Major Dick Hearn and I, I only give my driver one instruction, and that's to always, always walk around the back of the vehicle when I'm in it. After all, she said, who wants to see one's driver's arse passing by the front?
Terrific.
And I've lived by that maxim ever since.
Well, yes, one doesn't want to see one's driver's arse in any circumstances. I guess chauffeur would have been a bit nouveau riche, a bit Alan Sugar, wouldn't it?
I think it was. I think that's exactly it.
Yeah.
I think she liked to refer to the sort of old school and proper form of driver.
Yeah, so it's like when you're addressing the Queen, is that so many people make the mistake of calling her Mom all the way through.
Oh, dear.
And she doesn't like it.
No, it's Her Majesty the first time you address her, and then it's Ma'am, as in Madam, from then on.
Yes, I understand that's the protocol, isn't it? It's Your Majesty first, and then Ma'am, but never Mom. It's Ma'am as never Ma'am as in jam, isn't it?
Ma'am as in jam. Yes. Now, I tell you what, that's dealt with Her Majesty, the Queen Mother,
yes.
And her driver, and class matters. I don't know whether class came into our television viewing review programme this week. It was on BBC Two on Tuesday. Maybe you did find a matter of class in this, because BBC Two Tuesday, 8 o'clock PM, The Great British Sewing Bee. And, on it came with an intro styled like The Apprentice. Many applied, 8 were selected. And it soon became apparent that this programme had a huge debt to the Great British Bake Off. Indeed, it was made by the same people. It's so shameless was the familiarity of the Bake Off format that one script could have really have stood in for the other. We had the usual backstories, inevitably varied. One or two of the participants were on a journey, and the contenders ranged from the camp to the grandmotherly. So, presented by Claudia Winkleman, the Great British Sewing Bee, Magna Shaw.
Yes, you're absolutely right. We're going to be inundated with these now, aren't we? Because the British Bake Off has been such an enormous hit, and I think they've taken it to the States now, haven't they? That we're just going to transpose a hobby onto this format over and over and over again.
The great British bricklayer.
The great British hat wearer and the
yes,
great British toenail clipper and on it will go. But we're at the second iteration, aren't we? The great British showbiz. This program had a strange effect on me, I have to say. The first 15 minutes, I thought, I was looking around the room for sharp objects with which to do away with myself because I just couldn't fathom anything more tedious and less scintillating than watching people sew and talk about sewing and talk about darts and bents and such like. And this was in the early tasks that they had to do because they were fairly mundane tasks.
Were they an A-line skirt?
Yeah, an A-line skirt. Can you put a collar on this, let this out? Yeah. And it was like, stuff I couldn't do. Of course I couldn't, but that doesn't make it scintillating. But then when we came to the final task, which was to make, from scratch, in 7 hours, quite an elaborate dress, and obviously put some creativity into it, come up with something better and different from the other competitors, I suddenly realised I was quite drawn into it, and there was no way I was going to switch off before I found out what they'd all produced. Now,
I so didn't expect you to say this.
No, but... call me a sucker for the format, but I was quite on the edge of my seat, but halfway to the edge, and I really did want to see what they'd made, and I wanted to see, and of course it's edited in this quite compelling way, so you've got 8 minutes to go. Somebody is just removing the last pin of this glorious creation. Somebody's just got a big pile of cloth in front of them still. You go, oh my god, they're not going to have a dress to show. And it was also quite interesting how they skirted around the issue of talking about bust lines without getting
all skirted around the issue.
I do apologize. How they tried to be euphemistic about describing the bust line without the whole thing becoming smutty. That was quite interesting. But I was actually quite interested to see who made what it looked like, and who got knocked out. And then, of course, they dropped the bombshell about 10 minutes from the end. Somebody was taken ill. And had to leave the sewing room. Well, not only was it drama, it also engaged me in a good 2 or 3 minutes of trying to work out who it was, because I thought that could.
It was a really anonymous lady, wasn't it?
It must have been, because everybody I'd taken in, everybody registered with me, I could still see. So that got me even more enmeshed into the thing, trying to work out who it was who'd been taken ill. And then we got the results. So I think that sort of final grand task is much more compelling than the diddly little bits at the beginning, which were really killing me, I have to say.
The diddly bits when
but there was
the woman getting ill. Doesn't this always happen? Because on X Factor, Lucy Spraggan or whatever her name was, I mean, she had to leave the contest in the ill because she was ill. And didn't the winner of the Great British Bake Off slice his finger to smithereens in one episode?
Oh, he may have done. I didn't follow.
Oh, because you didn't watch
the whole thing. I'm obviously long enough in the tooth to appreciate that there are production tricks being played on me.
Yeah.
And but I don't mind that as long as they're being played with some panache, and pulling me in. And much against my better judgment and expectations, I was in the last half, so perhaps the last half an hour of the programme, quite interested to see what was going to happen. I won't probably follow the whole thing right through to its conclusion.
Oh, I bet you do. I bet you do. You'll be sitting next Tuesday, you'll be thinking, the sewing thing's gone.
Well, I might wait until half an hour's elapsed and then tune in for the big task. But,
I'll tell you what, I fast-forwarded through the bit of, there was like, how, because I watched it on delay.
Yes.
How to make your own laundry bag. Did I miss anything compelling there? Because I whizzed through that bit.
Well, this is the interesting, and I don't know if they do this on the Bake Off, but this is a little sidebar to the programme, which says, if you're about to nod off, then let us distract you by telling you how to do some sewing. I'm not sure this is really good, because I think anybody who's watching it because they're keen on sewing will be able to do some quite complex tasks themselves. And anybody who's watching because they're reviewing it for a podcast is never going to do any sewing. So I'm not sure there's the purpose behind this. But I'll tell you what you missed. Basically, it went, so while we're you know, they all go off to bed, don't they, and then come back the next day. So, well, while we're waiting for our contestants to return, we'll show you how to make a simple laundry bag. Really, the instructions were worthy of Viz, because it kind of said, choose your fabric, make a laundry bag. And now back to the competition.
Right. Yeah. It looked a bit like the bags kids used to take their plimsolls to school when I was about five.
A gym bag. Yes. It didn't have Nike or Reebok across the side.
No. Mothers used to make them out of old bits of cloth.
They did indeed. Yes, they put your plimsolls in. How right
put your
you are.
In them. How black plimsolls.
Yes. Yeah, well, that was a good point. I mean, who has a laundry bag?
What's
a laundry bag for? What's it for? Anyway, making one seemed incredibly simple and yet incredibly difficult and above all that, incredibly pointless. I thought it was nicely made. I thought the production values were very good. I thought the location was terrific. You would like to go and have a look around that big, sunlit sewing room, wouldn't you? It was somewhere in London quite,
Well, they did try hard to make Petticoat Lane in East London looking
exotic.
Which is not. It was sort of Dalston as a sort of artisan's paradise, wasn't it, from the filming? The bloke I really liked, I'm sure you noticed, fella, he goes to something called steampunk events, and I'd never heard of such a thing. I had to look it up, science fiction with steam-powered machinery and so on.
You've looked up the wrong thing.
Have I got it wrong?
You have, because that's steampunk literature.
Oh, right. Yeah. What was he then? A steampunk?
I mean, he would read steampunk literature, but he was a steampunk, devotee. So, I like steampunk. It's a fantastic, concept, really, which is to sort of take the 19th century and all its, frills and top hats and buckles and such like.
Yeah.
And then combine it with grunge and punk as a sort of look.
And I'm not taking the.
It's an interesting concept, and really, it's nothing that new, because a lot of McLaren's ideas for the styles that the punks should wear was to combine Dickensian London with a sort of post-apocalyptic London, wasn't it? That's what he was.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, it did have that sort of familiarity about it, sort of Gorman-Gast kind
that's
of.
It, yes,
feel.
Absolutely. Yeah, but he's interesting, isn't he? Because he's the last person you'd expect to be able to sew or have an interest in sewing, you know? And that's great to see somebody play against type. So it has a lot going for it. It was just such a slow start. It almost did me in, but not a bad finish. Yeah.
not a bad finish. And we don't want to give a spoiler, but in my view, the wrong person was sent home. Because, of course, everybody, it's the usual format, you know. So one person or two people it was supposed to be, but one got taken ill, as we said. Had to go home, and there was a Who Made the Best Piece award and all that sort of, the usual drama. But I thought the wrong person went home.
Yes, and I do wonder, talking about the tricks of television production, whether they tend to encourage that, because it gets you all fired up, doesn't it? If you say, I knew they'd go. Where's the tension there, you know?
I've already fallen in love with one of the contestants, like I did with the Bake Off. Do you remember there was gorgeous woman on the Great Bake Off?
Catherine.
Yes, Catherine.
Be still my beating heart.
I've fallen in love with Tilly.
Have you?
On the sewing thing, it always happens.
Rogue.
Terrible. Yeah. This was the Great British Sewing Bee. It was on BBC Two on Tuesday at 8 o'clock PM. Yeah. The judges, Mae Martin and Patrick Grant. It was presented by Claudia Winkleman, directed by James Morgan. It's a love production for the BBC. And here's the thing. If you missed it, it's available on the iPlayer for 4 weeks. So you've got no excuse. You can't miss it.
Yeah, no. But give it a chance. Stagger through the first half hour. It does get quite intriguing.
I think I'll give it another spin next week. Do you know what, Magnus, Sean? Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. It's time for our closing feature now, which is the pretend iPod, where we each pick a track that has some depth of meaning for us, and we tell everybody why, and then it joins the parade, the luxurious parade of musical hits that are available on this pretend iPod on the Rocking Vehicle website or under Spotify, on Spotify under the umbrella term Magnus Shaw.
Yes, indeed. Yes. You know all the people who came in to hear your Queen Mother story?
Yeah,
they're all going now.
Well, for the iPod,
yeah.
Her Majesty the Queen, not Her Majesty the Queen, Mott the Hoople.
Yes.
I always get those two mixed up.
It's an easy mistake.
Always get them mixed up. Mott the Hoople, not Her Majesty the Queen. It's spring 1972, and it's before All the Young Dudes. And my friend J.C. Carroll was quite a fan of Mott the Hoople. And in our school band, which later became the Members, mentioned before, J.C. taught us how to play Mott the Hoople's version of Laugh at Me, a Sonny Bono song. And we got quite adept at that very unusual song from one of the early Mott the Hoople albums. So spring 1972, as I say, and Mott the Hoople were playing Bracknell Sports Centre. So we all went along. And you know what? I think Mark Ellen was there too, which is a strange twist, 41 years later.
I'd fathom that Mick Jones may well have been there as well.
Really?
He rarely missed a Mott the Hoople gig, especially that close to London. I would say,
We were all there. So now, imagine this bit happening today at your Glastonbury or your O2 Arena. We strode up with the confidence of 16-year-olds. We strode up to Ian Hunter at the gig and asked him if we could get up on stage before their set, use their instruments, play a couple of songs. And he and the rest of Mott the Hoople said, yes.
No.
They didn't say, go beat a path back to your school. He said, yes. So I guess I can always add supported
Mott the Hoople.
What an amazing thing.
Perhaps you and I should try that at the Stones in Hyde Park this summer.
Yes. Just roll up to Jagger and Richard and say, lads, we get up on stage and we will use your instruments. Yeah. Get up on stage just and play a couple of our songs.
After the vaccines have finished, we'll jump up and do a bit.
Absolutely. So imagine that. But anyway, everyone was, of course, unaware of the huge upward turn that was about to rocket Mott the Hoople into the top 40 and the world of glam rock, because this was spring 72. And it was only later in 72 that, you know, it all took off. And this is this bit is all another kind of imagine this moment, because just imagine being in a band that isn't doing very well. And this happens. David Bowie comes along, big star, about to release Ziggy Stardust. And he offers the ailing and about to break up Mott the Hoople his song Suffragette City. And they said, no. They said,
good call, fellas.
Yeah, no, we're cool. No, thanks. They said, have you got anything else? And so he doesn't tell them, like they didn't tell me, to go take a walk. He offers them All the Young Dudes instead. And that's
you're just saying to Bowie, all right, you got anything else?
Yeah, I know, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
It is extraordinary,
But I suppose, would Suffragette City have been such a hit for them? It's hard to tell, isn't it, in the great scheme of things. But All the Young Dudes, they took and they released it as a single. It turned out to be their biggest hit. It reached number 3 in the UK and number 37 in the States. They were never really big in the States. But after this, and after another couple of full starts, after All the Young Dudes, Ian Hunter hit a short run of writing excellent pop singles in a sort of Bowie mould, but with a mixture of glam rock and Hunter's own insightful lyrics, I think. And it's amazing because in a run, it lasted only about 18 months. Successive singles, Honolulu Boogie, All the Way from Memphis, Roll Away the Stone, The Golden Age of Rock and Roll, Foxy Foxy and Saturday Gigs. And that was 18 months.
So in
1973, Mott the Hoople were just about a permanent fixture on Top of the Pops. So, and also, I think with Mott the Hoople, it's almost a perfect pop career. They were huge for a year or two, and then they broke up before the dry ice could clear behind them. To represent this period, I've chosen All the Way from Memphis, a rollicking tale of a rock group on the road. You climb up the mountains and you fall down the holes. It features some lovely plinky, plonky pub piano from Ian Hunter. Dale Griffin, the drummer, bash 'em fast, bash 'em hard kind of drum style, and saxophone a go-go from Andy Mackay out of Roxy Music.
Yes, indeed.
So you look like a star, but you're still on the dole. Recorded and released in 1973, reached number 10 in the UK Top 40, nowhere in the Billboard Hot 100, 4 minutes and 55 seconds, Her Majesty the Quick Note, Mott the Hoople, and All the Way from Memphis.
Yeah, good choice. What was interesting about Mott the Hoople, I think, was that they were caught, or at least Ian Hunter was very obsessed about the nature of being a rock star. A lot of their songs were about what they were doing,
yes.
Wasn't it? Was it the best?
Yes.
And then, of course, simultaneously, he wrote Diary of a Rock and Roll Star. Is that what it's called? Diary of a Rock and Roll Star, I think so.
Yes, I've reordered it this morning.
Oh, yeah, well...
I've no longer got it.
It's a fantastic read, and it really is the unimpeachable work on being a rock star, isn't it? It is.
I read it way back, and I can't hardly remember a word of it.
It's just so good. So he kind of invented, to that extent, postmodernism, didn't he? Because he was writing songs and books about the very thing that he was doing, which is being a rock star, which is quite interesting. And, of course, they were one of the few long-haired bands that the punks didn't quite want to set fire to. They were sort of acceptable to the punks, along with Roxy and Bowie, really, weren't they?
They were. Here's the thing about Ian Hunter, you maybe know this, but he's older than any of the Beatles. He was June 1939, so he'll be 74 in a couple.
And there was a smashing documentary on Mott the Hoople a couple of weeks ago on TV, and
that's what reminded me of.
Yeah, and there he was, and he doesn't look too bad on it, does he? Really?
Not for 74, he looks damn good, I have to say. And apparently, he's also a really nice fellow. A very old friend of mine plays in his band. He does tours most year as himself, not with Mott the Hoople. Mm. And a friend of mine plays drums in that band. Okay. And to all knowledge, he's a really nice fellow, Ian Hunter. And, 74 this year.
Yeah,
that's
amazing.
He was well into his 30s, 33, 34, when Hoople hit the big time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, as I mentioned, no bigger fan of Mott the Hoople than Mick Jones of The Clash, which draws you that line to the punk rock movement. Good pick. And all the young dudes, it's so good I can't say it. All the young dudes, just tremendous record, honestly.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Right, stand by. Here we go. Peach Blow, Pandora Pompadour, Pale Leaf, Pink Sweet, Persephone, Near Our Ivo, Peepo, Bit Animal, Peep Peep, He Didn't Deal Little Rito, Peep Peepo. Now, these words are hilarious, not just because they sound like I'm on some weird hallucinogenic mushrooms, although that might be a reason that they are hilarious, but because they are plucked from the internet earlier today, and they are one internet user's... some of us find some things funny, some of us don't, but I laughed for a long while at this, because it's one internet user's attempt to transcribe the lyrics of my pick for this week. Now, transcribing the lyrics of a song is something we all do. I mean, we can look them up now, but when you and I were little boys, we had to listen to the record and jot them down. But to pick the Cocteau Twins, is the band I'm speaking of, to do this is quite a hold to step into, because there's no actual lyrics. Now, I thought it was quite nice of this guy to just pick apart this record and try and transcribe them when there's nothing there to transcribe. So hats off to you, sir, whoever you are. The record that he's trying to transcribe is called Ivo, and it's from the 1984 Cocteau Twins album Treasure on 4AD Records. It's so fantastically idiosyncratic that it really proves that the Cocteau Twins were really more interested in sounds than words, by dint of the fact there aren't any real words. Sometimes there'll be foreign words in there, sometimes there'll be English words in there, sometimes it would be Elizabeth Fraser just making noises, and she's explained this many times, and of course not the same noises twice. So if you went to see the Cocteau Twins perform Ivo, you wouldn't hear her make the same noises that are on the record, because she would just enunciate syllables to go with the music that she was hearing. Now, this has an interesting idea, but you can imagine in the hands of some other artist, lesser artist, this might be a dreadful experience. So all credit to the Cocteau Twins. Robin Guthrie, Simon Raymond, and of course Elizabeth, who I just referred to, they managed to make it sound like music from some medieval fair on Mercury. is the best I can describe it. Now, when a less cultured me was first played Cocteau Twins music in the sort of early to mid-80s, I guess, I was totally perplexed, as perhaps was the guy who was transcribing their lyrics on the internet. It's those yelps and that sort of nursery rhyme melody and the masses of reverb and ethereal whimsy. They're all a bit slightly overwhelming at first, especially when you're a dyed-in-the-wool gothic punk in a set of unsuitable motorcycle boots. But in fairness to myself, it didn't take long before I was completely enchanted and went out and got myself a load of Cocteau Twins albums. And I still am pretty enchanted, I have to say. I think Elizabeth Fraser's an extraordinary talent because she does something that only she can do. So nobody else is going to go on stage and do what Elizabeth Fraser does. And that, you know, that in itself is worthy of a mention. So if you can listen to Ivo without being utterly spellbound, intrigued and captivated, then clearly you're made of sterner stuff than I am, because it is all those things, spellbinding, intriguing and captivating. It's the opening track from 1984's Treasure from the Cocteau Twins, and it's called Ivo. And it's called that because the owner of 4AD and their producer was also called Ivo.
I love Elizabeth Fraser, and she has the most extraordinary voice. And I'm going to say the most cliched critique, of course, but why couldn't they write proper songs? Why couldn't they write real words? Because I think they would have been huge if they had done so. I just think using, you know, it strikes me as a little bit lazy. It's like, oh, put your feet up, you know, scribble any old thing will do. I totally accept the atmosphere and, you know, Ivo, the song is lovely atmosphere generated, but why not use real words?
Oh, because everybody else uses real words. So I think you're not so much missing the point as booking a first class aeroplane right round the other way from the point.
I know.
It's experimenting, using the voice as an instrument without the restriction of words. I think that's fantastic, if you can do it as well as the Cocteau Twins. I
mean, she does do it well. She's one of the most gorgeous voices in pop, rock, whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely.
Lovely voice.
And of course, if you listen to an album, the one that references Las Vegas in the title, how remiss of me, I can't bring it to mind. Most of the songs on that are in proper English with proper lyrics. So
Heaven or Las Vegas.
Thank you very much. It just flew out of my mind the minute I tried to say it. Yes, Heaven or Las Vegas.
Someone told me. I didn't know. I had to be told.
Yes, aren't we all hopeless? Yes, and we know these things. We're just getting too old to recall them. And that most of the songs on there, if not all of them, have proper lyrics in proper English. So that might.
Oh, I'm going to listen to that.
Well, that might
then
be the one for you. Yes.
That's the one for me.
Yeah, but I love that idea of not singing the acknowledged words and just using syllables as instruments is a tremendous concept. They do it so well, or Liz Fraser does it so well. So I can't buy into what you're saying there. I think that's what a concept, and it can only be done once, and fortunately it was done so brilliantly by the Cocteau Twins.
No, fair point. I hadn't looked at it that way, I must say. I'll listen afresh, but I will listen to that album, the Las Vegas album, with the real
proper songs on it.
Proper songs. Like
they
we
sang
used to do in the old days.
Yes. Yeah. Like we used to sing in underground when bombs were falling.
That's it, exactly.
Yeah. Yes. So that's my pick. Ivo, okay. Cocteau Twins. Great. So good couple of tracks to add onto the old pretend iPod there, and they will be present, well, pretty much alongside this podcast being published. Anything that else you'd like to bring to the table, sir?
I've just got a final couple of words
good
for you.
Yes.
And Neong Hai Gyo Seo.
Well, that's very kind of you. And yes, I will see the doctor on Tuesday. And now I'm going to switch you off with my remote control ring that I'm wearing here. I'm going to close your microphone and switch off the entire Parish Council podcast for another week. Thanks very much for your time and your input. It's always greatly appreciated. And for you guys at home, another big thank you. We'll look forward to seeing you again in 7 days. Bye-bye. My axe is cold.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shore media production.
Wake up in the morning, there's a snap around the place. Wake up in the morning, there's a crackle in your face. Wake up in the morning, there's a pop that really says, right, this is for you, and you, and you. Pour on the milk and listen to the snap that says it's nice. Pour on the milk and listen to the crackle of that rise. Get up in the morning to the pop that says it's right. Hear them talking crisp, Rice Krispies.